Even during cold, dark winter days, Alaskans are out skiing, walking, and biking. We know outdoor activity is not only good for our physical bodies, but it also helps build more connected, thriving, and safe communities. So how can community planners safely have people and cars coexist in the same spaces without breaking their budgets? There are unique transportation corridor concepts that consider all users, and we'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. For the first time in decades, the life expectancy of Americans is declining. Obesity, diabetes, heart trouble, depression, and a host of other health problems are a direct result of our collective lack of physical activity. Simply telling couch potatoes to move it hasn't proven to be very successful. But what if you lived in a neighborhood where it was easy to walk or bike to the store, the library, a coffee shop, or a concert? What happens then? We've got guests that can tell us exactly what happens. In the studio with me is Steve Cleary. Steve is the executive director of Alaska Trails. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And joining us from the studios of WGBH in Boston is Mark Fenton. Mark is an MIT engineer and a transportation expert. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Lori. How are you? Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mark.
So good to have you both here. And you, Alaskans, can join the conversation too. Are there roads in your area, your community, that are not friendly for pedestrians or bicycles? Do you think this is important? Are you working to change it? Give us a call. You can reach us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, as a couple of people already have, talk@alaskapublic.org. We'll get to those questions in a bit. But Mark, you were just in Anchorage in October working with transportation officials here. You've been here in the past. I wanted to people to know that you're familiar with Alaska transportation issues. Let's start with an overview of some of the terminology that I heard when we were speaking earlier in the fall. What's meant by complete streets design and, one of my favorites, tactical urbanism?
So those are two actual national movements. They're going on all over the country, and it was really a privilege to be up in Anchorage again, having not been there for about 7 or 8 years, and see a lot of the good stuff that's happening, and also the opportunities. Complete streets is, at its heart, a very simple premise. It says every time we touch a road, that road's not complete unless we take into account all four users, the pedestrian, the bicyclist, a transit user, and the motor vehicle. So in other words, an incomplete street could just take care of cars. But if you want it to be complete, you got to think about where everybody goes. And it doesn't mean every road has a bike lane or a 20-foot sidewalk on the side. It means we take into consideration what other land uses are, where the road goes, the volume of traffic, but we think about all four users all the time and try to find accommodation. So that's complete streets. Tactical urbanism is a way to try it out, basically. So it sounds like a form of combat, but it's really a very positive thing. Lots of communities do what we would call tactical urbanism trials or pop-ups even, where they'll take a road that we think may be oversized. We've got an awful lot of asphalt out there. We've painted three lanes in each direction. We really don't need it. Maybe we could turn the outermost lane into a protected bicycle lane, a bike lane where there's a, you know, an actual buffering strip of a foot and a half or two of paint between the bike lane and the traffic lane. Now, that's not everywhere, but sometimes that happens when traffic moves off of a road or when there's, you know, maybe there's a bypass created. And that road can actually be reduced in width, But we may not want to go out tomorrow and change it permanently. So we could do a tactical urbanism trial where we put up some cones or some planters or some really nice-looking treatments that look very permanent but, in fact, are quite temporary. Try it out for a day, a week, a month. See if it works. And then if we like it, make it permanent. And we can do that with things like mini roundabouts or circles. We can change parking alignments. We can improve crosswalks, often with temporary materials that allow you to try it out tactically, see how it is. You know, maybe people say, oh, I'm not sure you can do that. How's the biggest fire truck going to make it around the corner? Well, bring the biggest fire truck and try it, you know. And so the idea is complete streets is a broad principle. Tactical urbanism is one of the ways we're testing it and trying things, I think, far more productively than we used to.
All right. You've both talked about the triple bottom line. Steve, do you want to take that? What is meant by that?
Well, it's showing that trails and bike and pedestrian infrastructure is good not only for economic development, but for community health and environmental health as well. And so as I started out as a committed biker, I didn't expand. I was focused more on bikes and bike lanes and what those could do. But having worked with experts like Mark Fenton, it's broadened out to show that, hey, this is good for business. It's, of course, good for the environment, but it also helps kids and adults achieve a healthy weight and make sure that they're healthy. So it's good for all aspects of our community.
You're based in Anchorage, Steve, as am I, but there are projects across the state, Kotzebue, Russian Mission, Bethel, Thorne Bay, Sitka. We're not just talking about large urban areas. There was a write-up about a Safe Routes to School program that helped a student in Naknek realize her desire for a better route for walking to school. Tell us about some of those projects that are going on across the state in small communities.
Sure. Yeah, and that one's particularly in Naknek is a real good example of community ingenuity, and that's something that I like to focus on. And it happened right as I was starting at Alaska Trail, so I heard about it and was really amazed by its success. But a third grader, of which I have one as well, came up with the idea. She wanted to have a safe way to get to school, somewhere to exercise, and some way to get out of the pollution, particularly in the winter, you know, that was focused right around the school and school drop-off in Naknek. And so she started talking, and I always appreciate her quote that she was amazed at how long it took to build a simple trail. But she navigated the bureaucracy. She got Safe Routes to School funding. She got help from the National Park Service, Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. And the local community chipped in as well, and volunteers were able to do a lot of stuff as well. So not only did she get a path to her school, but there were stops along the way with exercise equipment, and it actually incorporated a drop-off area that was a little bit away from the school so that the pollution would be further away from the school and that everybody would get a little walk along a lighted path that was already in existence there in Naknek. And so that's a Safe Routes to School project that was highlighted, and it really shows what community members can come up with when they work together and try to achieve something that was student-led and student-driven and really good for the health of the community.
That's something that I just so admire and applaud, is that here is a young person who, you know, has no political power or financial backing, but yet was able to get the community to rally around this idea and brought it forward and had success with it. I mean, that's just a fantastic story for any young person out there that's thinking about these things.
Sure. And there's going to be lots more ideas, and we hope that great Safe Routes to School projects like that will continue all across Alaska.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we are talking about transportation design for community connection and for community health. Our guests today are Steve Cleary. He is the executive director of Alaska Trails. He's in the studio with me, and Mark Fenton, who is an MIT engineer and a transportation expert. He's joining us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments about the transportation issues that you may be facing in your communities. Alaska has a lot of communities that don't have many roads. but yet people still have to get around safely in those communities. Give us a call statewide, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go to the phones for a moment and talk to Sean, who is in Douglas. Hi, Sean.
Yes, hello. I'd like to talk to you about a couple issues, distracted driving and pedestrian safety among those.
All right.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a dicey cell connection, but I think we'll get through it.
Okay, I'll take you off the speakerphone here.
Perfect.
I live out on Douglas Island, which is a suburb of Juneau, Alaska, and it's recently repaved, and they did put bicycle lanes along the Douglas Highway, but it's a long, skinny, you know, head-to-head 40-mile-an-hour, which usually ends up being 50. And it seems like the universal uniform for people walking along the edge, which has virtually no sidewalks, is dark hoodie, black pants. Very frequently, infrequently do you see people with any kind of reflective gear. And I think the efforts to provide that to people have been almost wholly unsuccessful, especially, you know, with teenagers and younger people where style is a paramount concern. I'd like to discuss maybe how important it is to have physically separate bike lanes instead of just a paint stripe, which offers no protection. People park in the bike lane. Distracted drivers are frequently deviating over the bike lane. There's no sidewalks paralleling that road. It's a dangerous situation when you have the really long, dark winter nights.
Yes, so true. You know, when you were mentioning, Sean, about people wearing dark clothing, I see that so often in Anchorage where somebody is walking with a black jacket, black jeans, and you just can't see them unless you're really looking closely. And so I really take to heart your thoughts about the importance of pedestrian safety. And Mark, you were in October when you were here discussing the idea of completely separate bike lanes. Talk a little bit about what that takes and what kind of costs is involved.
Right. There's some fairly recent research on this. It's pretty compelling. And that is that if we're thinking about getting meaningful numbers of people walking and bicycling on a regular basis, so not just the hardcore serious bicyclist who's already got Lycra and a very fancy bike and kind of ride in any conditions, and they've got the big fat tire bike for the winter and their skinny tire bike for the summer. They're great. But if we were thinking about how do we help more people ride more often, what the research tells us is you're much more likely to get large numbers out on the road, on bicycles in particular, if you have protected facilities or buffered facilities. That is, a facility that has, just like Sean's talking about, some physical separation from the roadway, from the active travel lane. And even if it's just the striping of a slightly wider stripe, a foot and a half or two, so that there's a physical buffer that's visual, you know, striped with the high visibility reflective paint so that your headlights see it, that makes a difference. Better still if there's some vertical delineation. There are these things called delineators, those plastic stakes that stick up out of the ground that are flexible. If your car hit it, it wouldn't do any damage, but they have, reflective material on them, and they really delineate the edge from the bike lane or the side path from the road. And then better still would be further physical separation, where it's an actual side path. That is, it's a pathway that meanders on the ground, separate from the roadway. What we know is more people will tend to use those, and indeed, just as Sean said, they're much safer because you don't have a tired driver drifting into the lane. You don't have a disabled vehicle pulling over into the lane. When work crews stop, they pull over and use that lane. Right, they park their trucks there. Delivery vehicles will sometimes park in the lane. So those are all reasons that having some physical separation is really, really beneficial. And what's notable is we're seeing them both in urban areas, so in a city like Anchorage or Juneau, but also on stretches of more rural road where we know the speeds really get up, just like he described. You know, it's posted 40, but people are really going 50, 55. That physical separation, huge difference, protects the bicyclist tremendously and would be much more likely to get more people to use it, which actually makes it safer, because there's research that tells us if I'm expecting to see bicyclists there, my behavior as a driver is better too, right? If I'm not surprised by an occasional bicyclist, but if people regularly use it. So those are all reasons to build the system that way and to take advantage of that kind of design.
Well, you know, we have a combination of concerns in Alaska this time of year. Not only do we have very low light, we're down to in Anchorage to about 5.5 hours a day.
Yeah.
But we also like so many other places, have way too many people who are looking at their cell phone when they're driving. And so is there research that if you can't get an actual barrier for a bike lane, what about those sort of drive over little button things that make noise when you run over them? Is there any research that says that that's a lower cost way of also helping bike lanes? Because if somebody's texting, at least if they hit that, they will be alerted and move over.
Yep, and they do help with driver behavior. One of the issues is bicyclists will tell you, but it's a problem for me to try to get over that when I have to make a left turn, cross the street, things like that. So we tend to see them done sort of sporadically, and at intervals, you know, so that you have a section of 40 feet of that little rumble strip or texturing, whatever you want to call it, then a break, then a strip again. So there are ways to design that in that can work very well. And, you know, in my perfect world, you use a little bit of everything. So you'd use that so that you get the tire noise if you begin to drift to the right. You'd have some of those vertical delineators that would catch my eye because the reflective thing picks up my headlights. You know, and indeed, those aren't super expensive. In general, the trick is doing this stuff when you're doing construction anyway. So the whole idea of complete streets is, if that's your policy, then every time you touch the road, we're going out to repave it anyway. There are potholes. We have to do repaving. It's a very easy time to put in those the textured rumble strip, right? Whereas if we have to go out and do it especially now and it's a special project, costs a lot of money. Do it when I'm paving anyway? Not so much. And that's why we want to be thinking about this stuff all the time. Sean said they had just repaved out there. That would have been the perfect time to do some of this because you've got the equipment out. Marginal cost's pretty low.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Sean, for the call. Let's go now to Joseph in Petersburg. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. So my concern is the recent fad of driving around with headlights in the daytime. It kind of makes it harder to be pedestrian. And as a primarily bicycle.
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Right.
We're having a hard time hearing you, Joseph. You're breaking up some. Your concern is headlights and pedestrians?
I think I heard him say that as a cyclist, and he can correct us via phone or email if I'm wrong, that the bright headlights coming at him was a distraction for him even during the day. And so that's something we talk about even on trails. You can come up to some bright cyclists' lights if you're walking or skiing, and so so being cognizant that that sometimes your lights, whatever variety, may be too bright and maybe a distraction is another good safety tip.
All right, Joseph, I hope we answered your question or your concern. Sorry that we had a bad connection there.
Could I add?
Sure. Please do, Mark.
Some of what we're talking about here is also the behavior of the pedestrian, the bicyclist. Let's not dump it all on the driver, right? I mean, I like to design the road so it's maximally effective for all users. By the same token, I want a generation of bicyclists that know they should have flashers on their bikes, right? And, you know, in low light conditions, and they should have a headlight. And that, to Steve's point, that when you're riding on a trail where you're going to have pedestrians, maybe you aim that light down so it's not right in the eyes of pedestrians. Simple things. And or for pedestrians, how about just wearing a reflective vest if you're walking in the winter months, right? Having one of those high visibility reflective vests on if you're on the road. All of this is part of, I think, another part of the kind of work that we should be doing, which is to raise the next generation of bicyclists and pedestrians. And, you know, I'd love to see pedestrian and bicycle safety training in every school PE program, and I'd love every school to have a high-quality physical education program. Mm-hmm. But we need to think about, and there are some really cool programs out there that do just this. You know, let kids, when they're in first and second and third grade, they start to learn as pedestrians safety features. I always cross at the crosswalk, stop, look, and listen, you know, that kind of stuff. Wear reflective materials at night. And then as they get older, second, third, and fourth grade and beyond, we teach them bicycle safety skills. You know, wouldn't it be great if that were just considered normal? In some European countries where they've been very successful increasing the number of pedestrians and bicyclists, you know, how much people walk and bike, not just drive cars, they've done that. They've institutionalized bike and ped safety education right into the school systems and so on.
Well, you know, Mark, you are segueing beautifully into a question that we had by email, which is about the role of transportation culture. And this person, Jessie in Fairbanks, says she'd like our guest to address this, and how a lack of awareness or familiarity with non-car-centered modes of travel creates problems for bikers and drivers. When you were talking about institutionalizing this idea, Jesse was saying, when I ride my road bike, fully visible lights, reflective yellow jacket on the shoulder of major Fairbanks roads, I frequently get aggressive reactions like honking and speeding by at close proximity. She says, I'm riding legally, but I wonder if there's just a perception that bikes don't belong, which stems from a lack of exposure to bike culture. That goes hand in hand with what you were talking about institutionalizing the rights of all users for roadways. So talk a little bit about this. Steve, you ride your bike. You're a bicycle commuter, and I'm sure you can relate to some of what Jesse's saying about concerns about traffic and people who may not be aware that you have every right to be on the road.
Sure. That's exactly the point. And not only the right, but also the responsibility to drive, to bike, to walk, following the rules. And former police chief here in town, Mark Mew, he and I were on a similar show like this talking about it. And he's a biker himself. And really, I remember a piece that he wrote for the paper where it outlined that, you know, like it or not, you know, bikes belong on the road, and they have there's a 3-foot passing rule. There's other safety features that are imbued in those laws that make it safe for bicycles and for people to follow those rules. And so what we want to see is people recognizing that, and recognizing that biking, walking are choices that people can make, and they're good for our community.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Annie is in Fairbanks. We just had an email question from someone in Fairbanks. Annie is in Fairbanks and has a comment about bike lanes. Hi, Annie.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for taking my call. I am actually a test driver, and I've been in Alaska for many years, but I've been out in Michigan for family reasons for the last couple of years. So I've actually covered a lot of ground, and I've seen a lot of bike and vehicle interaction. And I was really blown away. First of all, I just, coming out of Anchorage, which is where I was last in Alaska, I love the trails. I applaud Anchorage and all of the active people who are on the trails, including myself. But this kind of dovetails along the lines of the last couple of callers and the email. I mean, unless you are literally on the trail, you are, for the most part, taking your life in your hands to be out on the city streets, as the email just mentioned, even if you have the proper gear and all of the lighting. And the worst case scenario that I couldn't...
Uh-oh.
We lost her.
Oh, there you are. We lost you for a moment, Annie.
Okay. In my hometown in Michigan, I saw the worst, you know, as they claim to be progressive and bike lanes are coming, but I literally saw the bicycle symbol being painted in the lane of traffic so that there was no, and it even had the bike route sign on the side of the road. So you're thinking that there's a bike route, but the bike symbol is literally painted on the pavement as in the same lane where the cars are traveling. Hmm. And so I thought, please, as everyone is going forward, know that it seemed like the city council or whomever was coming up with the so-called bike lanes, it was just the worst example. Therefore, you know, I guess what is the option, that people are supposed to be on the sidewalk with pedestrians?
So I've got to tell Annie a quick story. That actually is one kind of treatment that engineers can opt to use. It's called a sharo, or a shared use arrow, and it's an actual bike symbol with a double chevron arrow that gets painted in a lane if it's an appropriate lane to do that in. And this may or may not have been, Annie, having not seen it. But it's part of sort of a hierarchy. You can imagine on a quiet neighborhood street, you might not put anything down. You might just say, traffic goes very slow. There aren't many cars. It's fine for a person to ride their bike right in the road, and cars are going to look at them, and the cars in the neighborhood only go 15 miles an hour. Not a problem. Then you might get to a slightly bigger street with a little more traffic, but not a lot, and it's not going very fast, you might paint a sharrow, this shared use arrow that says, this is a road in which bikes and vehicles will have to share the lane. So drivers, don't be surprised if there's a bicyclist out there. Bicyclists, know that cars are in this lane too. Everybody drive appropriately. Now, the fact that you didn't know that is sort of one of the shortfalls of sort of the whole education system that I was talking about, where we're not even familiar with that idea yet. Then the next level up would be sort of that bike lane where it is a single line that says bikes over here, cars over there. Again, moderate traffic, not really fast. And then what we were talking about before, the separated bike lanes. And my point would be that the low end, things like no bike lane or just the sharrows, we should use very sparingly because those are only for places where it's not a lot of traffic, it's not fast, there's not going to be a lot of conflicts between cars and bikes. As you get to higher volumes of vehicles and faster speeds, you really want at least a line or even greater separation. And and that's the kind of the, how you build a network, right? It's not all the same thing. That's the idea of complete streets. You use the right tool for the right place is the trick.
Right. Well, this even actually, ironically, it drove right. You were riding right past the middle school in the city,
You
know, where there would be super, high frequency of interaction between pedestrians and. But I will just say, I heard of a fantastic program. It was up in Traverse City, Michigan, where there was a couple that had gotten together an organization where they were actually helping to. Ride kids to school, kind of like a
group
riding to school, which I thought was a fabulous idea. I'm apologizing. I can't remember the name of the
Well, it sounds like Mark may be familiar with it. Let's let him tell us about it. Thanks so much, Annie, for raising it.
Annie, that is great, and you're absolutely right. Traverse City is doing great work. I was just there last year. They have a great Safe Routes to School program. I hope Steve will tell a little about the work he's doing on that there in Anchorage and across the state. The idea is creating environments where more kids walk and bike to school. And they create one of the tools is to create either a walking school bus or a bicycle train. That's what Annie was describing, where one or two adults will ride with a group of kids. You usually put one adult at the front, one at the back, and let all the kids ride like a train. And the parents ride them to school. You always select the safest route. You avoid conflicts. You help the kids get through key intersections. There's always an adult present. And the idea is often that parents will share the burden. You know, I might do one day, Steve another day, another parent from our neighborhood the third day. My wife created a walking school bus, same idea, just on foot, one or two adults walking with a group of kids. And it was very successful in our neighborhood. And we found, by the way, over time, it created that cultural shift that a number of the callers have been talking about. How do we shift the culture? People got accustomed to seeing this group of kids walking to and from school every day. They knew the route. They knew about the time they were going to come by. We had the adults with them. But over time, the parents got more and more relaxed because we realized, you know, the older kids are looking out for the younger ones. They have the skills. We're teaching them how to cross, what route we want them to take. We got a crossing guard installed at a key intersection. All of those collective changes, even repainting some crosswalks, can in fact lead to the cultural change we're talking about. It's not like a 2x4 to the side of the head. This is pretty easy stuff, right? It's not rocket science. But we do have to make a conscious effort. And things like bike trains and walking school buses are a great example.
Well, and I want Steve to tell us about the programs here, but we're going to take a short break first, and we will continue our conversation about pedestrian safety and sharing the transportation corridors between four different user groups: pedestrians, people on bicycles, people who use mass transit, and, of course, those who use their cars or their trucks. As Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing modes of transportation in your communities. And we were just hearing from a caller who was talking about safe routes to schools. Mark was talking about walkable school buses, which I love that idea. Just this little train of kids going to school. It's fantastic. And Steve, talk about the programs that are in place here, maybe in Anchorage and in other communities in Alaska that help kids get to school, but get more exercise at the same time.
Yeah, and I wanted to highlight that when Mark was here in town in October, he talked about programs, projects, and policies. So we've got policies like complete streets, and then we've got projects that are on the ground happening, maybe putting in a bike lane, striping, and then programs, which are exciting things to me, like walking school buses and bike trains. And there's great groups around the state, including right here in Anchorage. The Alaska Injury Prevention Center has done both walking school bus studies and some pilot projects, but a real exciting bike safety program in coordination with the Anchorage School District. And so the Alaska Injury Prevention Center got a Safe Routes to School grant to buy a trailer and 35 bikes that now go around to area schools. It was at my son's school a couple months ago, and I got to volunteer that day. But they're teaching bike safety to upper primary and then middle schoolers who are having fun, getting some good exercise, but they're learning to share the road at a young age, and they are excited about it. And so it's building that culture, showing that it could be your son and daughter or your grandma or your grandpa or your parent or your uncle, you know, showing that that bikers are, or that anybody could bike, and that we need to be respectful in all those things. And so what the folks at AIPC are hoping to show is that by teaching bike safety, not only will you have educated bikers, but they'll in turn become better drivers and more considerate, right, and following the rules of the road and those responsibilities that we were talking about earlier.
Sure, sort of being ambassadors for that larger message of going home than it may be saying to an uncle that might be cranky about bicyclists on the road, saying, hey, uncle, these guys have every right to be there, too, and helping to educate their families.
Yep, and it's really...
There's research.
Oh, please, go ahead, Mark.
Yes.
No, only there's research that as you increase the number of bicyclists and pedestrians on the road, you actually tend to see injury and fatality rates go down, you know, rates per kilometer of exposure, because drivers tend to see them, expect them more. The things that you do to get more bicyclists and pedestrians out there tend to enhance safety, you know, improved crosswalks, things like that. But then there's this cultural shift phenomenon, too. If I'm occasionally a bicyclist, then when I'm in my car, I'm a little more thoughtful about other people on a bicycle,
yes,
right? I just kind of get it. And I think, you know, we've seen it tip in cities and towns across the country. Traverse City is an example, the one that Annie just gave, where they've kind of, that cultural of biking and walking is picking up. But, you know, the Portland, Oregon's, you've heard about it, the Seattle's, the Boulder, Colorado's. But, you know, Anchorage, your guys are going to track that way. And here's the point I often make to elected and appointed officials. These are the quality of life factors that businesses want to locate in cities, where we're seeing, you know, millennials want to go to these kinds of communities. So the nice piece of this story is, in making the case for this, we're not just doing the touchy-feely, it's good for bicyclists, you know. We're saying this is good for the culture of your community, for quality of life, for social cohesion. There are a lot of really, and for business. The business community is interested in this stuff.
And the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation here in town with their Live, Work, Play campaign and the Trails Initiative that is part of that really gets it. And so we want to see that connection between the trails and bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure that'll get people where they want to go, not only to work and school, but to the library, to the store, to all the errands that are happening right now, maybe by car, giving them the option of biking or walking safely to those destinations.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-TALK. You can call 550-8422 in Anchorage, 550-8422, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment. Alice is in Talkeetna. Hi, Alice.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Did you have a comment about electric bikes?
I do. All the trails and everything says no motorized vehicles, but electric bikes really help somebody go 20 miles instead of just 10 for commuting. And the electric bikes are a wonderful addition to people really utilizing trails.
So you'd like to see some of that education perhaps around changing rules for multi-use on trails?
Yeah, the trails all say no motorized vehicles, but having an electric bike is just a bike that lets you get there
a little more efficiently. It's still a bike, though.
You know, that's something that Steve and Mark, we had talked about this fall, about the advantage of these kinds of slightly motorized bicycles, especially for elders or people who may have health challenges that couldn't otherwise get out. I know, Mark, that you spent a lot of time in your career examining how people move. That was part of your training as an engineer, looking at how people, their joints work, and you worked in sports medicine for a long time. Talk a little bit about, Steve and Mark, about Alice's concern around electric bikes and what they really can do to help other people that might be less mobile get out there.
Well, I know that I'll go first, Mark, just real briefly. Yeah. I know that in Anchorage, there's some level and some speed that they have designated for electric bikes on trails. And so it could be a safety concern if they were going too fast. But if that's the push for getting people onto a bike, then it seems like it could be a beneficial thing. But and I don't have them at the tip of my fingers, but I know that the municipality, at least here in Anchorage, has guidelines and rules that allow a certain amount of battery or a certain amount of miles per hour.
Okay, so Alice, maybe there's a way that you could have officials in Talkeetna sort of examine how that's handled in Anchorage and what the compromises are here. Mark, did you want to jump in there?
That's being done in other cities, too, so you can look at some other examples. But that's exactly right, because the biggest risk factor is if there's a big differential in speed. If I'm walking at 3 miles an hour and a bike hits me at 25, I can get really hurt.
Sure.
But if the bike has a governor on it such that it's not going faster than, you know, 20, 22 miles an hour, then it's just not a big deal. So speed is usually the determinant, not whether or not it's got an electric assist motor. But I got to tell you, I think Alice makes a really important point. As we look at aging baby boomers, as we look at a population that, you know, at some point I'm going to get to the age where they've got to take the keys away. I shouldn't be driving anymore. I could still be walking. I could even conceivably still be bicycling, particularly with an electric assist bike. We see people with modest levels of physical disability able to use an electric assist bike. It's certainly good in an area where you've got challenging topography, right? We've got hills, where you've got weather conditions that might make the trail or the path a little more challenging. So I think it is a coming technology. They're getting better and better. The bikes are getting lighter and lighter. The batteries are. The motors are getting more efficient. And the trick is not to turn it into a thing that can scoot along at 40 miles an hour on the bike trail, but just help somebody who needs that little extra bit get up a hill, hold their speed, go for a little further. We're going to see more of them, and I think you'll see more municipalities doing exactly what Steve described, which is figure out a way to have them on the trails in a safe manner.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have a lot of interest today. Will is in Chugiak. Hi, Will.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Good.
Good, thanks.
Good. I wanted to, first of all, give kudos to Alaska Trails. Steve has been helping us build recreational mountain bike trails out here in Chugiak that we're really excited about. So thank you, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I really struck me, this is a very inspiring show. Thank you guys for putting it together, the idea of increasing use, making it safer, and kind of this just getting the ball rolling and expanding into safer and more diverse modes of transportation is great. We had an instance out here in Chugiak where they were redoing the old Glen Highway, and they were redoing the bike lane, and I believe it was the state decided to, you know, put in the bike lane. It had a pretty wide stripe there. It was, say, maybe 6 feet wide directly across from the elementary school, with the idea of being able to plow it in winter so that they could save money and not have to have a separate, a path plow. But what happened, this idea that we heard the talks of rumble strips and the vertical dividers, was that in winter you can't see the stripes. And it was on the inside of a turn, and immediately after the first snowfall, cars just were cutting that corner, and they were driving over onto the path. And luckily, we had a sympathetic state legislator who basically lobbied the Department of Transportation to install a guardrail. So they did have to come back afterwards and put in this pretty significant guardrail. It might be more than was actually needed, but this idea of doing it right the first time, trying to save a little bit of money,
yeah,
and ending up having to go back. And
seems like it would have been much cheaper to design it that way the first time around. Correct, Mark?
Yeah, and if I may, I'm going to give credit to Steve here also, because when I visited, we actually got to meet with the DOT, the Department of Transportation there in Anchorage, and talked a little about this kind of stuff. And I think there's a receptivity to that. There's an increasing acceptance of the idea of complete streets at the State Department of Transportation level, not just by individual municipalities. And that's really important, because that's one of those kind of things that you could save a substantial amount of dough if you did that in the first place. And I think this is all fairly new, right? We're learning from the cities that have been early in on this, the places that have started to really build bicycle infrastructure, pedestrian infrastructure, that have been doing it for 20 years. We can look at that. There's an organization called the National Association of City Transportation Officials that have published guidebooks on roadway design, bikeway design, transit-oriented design. I implored AMATS, which is your regional metropolitan planning organization in the city, to actually adopt those manuals as guidance, design guidance, because it talks about this stuff. And it would have suggested maybe that road get that design right at the very beginning, you know, when we realize we've got a blind turn. Because I commend them for thinking about making it wide enough to plow, but that also makes it feel wide enough to feel like a driving lane, right? So having that physical delineation really makes a big difference. And I think it's great they came back and fixed it, because that's the stuff that takes 3 years, 5 years to get done. So that's terrific.
And having a policy that overarches that, something like complete streets, where you build
Correct.
Where streets are built to share, doesn't have to have a community members like Will was just talking about coming out for every project. You've got this umbrella over all of them, highlighting what can and should be done.
All right,
and in the long run, you save dough. You save money in the long run doing it that way.
And we like that.
Yes,
Will,
exactly.
Will, thanks for the call. Let's go back to the email questions here. We've got quite a number of those as well. And we seem to be striking a nerve in Fairbanks, because here's another one from Fairbanks. Genevieve says, what are some strategies for more rural areas to build continuous multi-use trails, roads to the urban center? Is it just a matter of getting funds for widening the road or increasing the size of the shoulder? She says she lives in Fairbanks above the Goldstream Valley, about 10 miles from UAF, and there are lots of people who bike or cross-country ski, commuting to and from work, but the shoulder's narrow, and pedestrian traffic is limited. Bikes are in a dangerous situation with fast traffic. She wants to know, are federal funds available for rural to urban multi-use paths, or is it generally just local borough funds that have to build these kinds of pathways? Steve?
Well, I think it's going to be a combination of both, but there's a newer program that Alaska just took advantage of called the Transportation Alternatives Program, which this year funded about $19 million worth of projects across the state, including sidewalk money for Yukon Drive up near UAF in Fairbanks. But we want to see programs like that continue, that could fund safe routes to school projects, that could, as I mentioned before, and as Will mentioned out in Chugiak, kind of harness that community ingenuity so they can see problems on the ground, and maybe it's $7,000 for lights somewhere or some reflective vests or something on the inexpensive side, or it's a project that is being redesigned, and so adding some more funding can put in that bike lane or that pedestrian facility that's needed. But I think Mark probably has some good examples of rural roads that could be examples for what could happen up in Fairbanks.
Mark?
Absolutely. And one of the tricks is to have a plan in place. So one of the best steps we can take is to think in advance, right? Like right now, look at the region. Look at where what we would call the important trip generators are. So as she pointed out, the UAF campus, but where are their housing clusters? Where's their shopping? Where's the public library, schools? And then build a plan that says, okay, these are the important things we've got to network together. We've got to connect, right? And we're going to do it over time. We're not going to snap our fingers, get $4 billion from the federal government and just go do it. But what we might do is say, anytime we do anything along any of these corridors, by the way, it might be an old utility corridor. It might be where a gas line runs underground, that when we're doing work on that, we could put a nice trail on top of that, right? Or an old rail corridor. But it could be when a road is being repaved. That's when we widen up the shoulders. Increasingly, by the way, public works departments like to see wide shoulders. They know it gives them that place to put a vehicle off on the side if they have to. They know it separates the bicyclists or pedestrians from the travel lane and actually makes everything move more smoothly. So there's receptivity to this idea. I know that Steve's working on that, and others are working on the idea of an active transportation plan in the greater Anchorage area. But really, every community ought to have one that sort of has their priority list so that as soon as we are out there going to touch that road, we know, hey, wait a minute, that's on our plan. This was one of the roads we've got to improve the bike facility because there's a middle school up there, an elementary school here, and a big residential cluster down here and some senior housing, right? So those are the kinds of things that get us to make these changes over time very effectively.
And I should point out that Fairbanks is leading Alaska as the first community with a complete streets policy. So
right.
Anchorage and AMATS and lots of other folks here in Anchorage want to follow that that lead. But that's an exciting policy that Fairbanks has in place.
Fantastic.
And it really bodes well.
Yes. Let's go back to the phones. Terry is in the Mat-Su. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Lori. I'd like to champion what the previous callers have said about you taking up this topic. I live in Mat-Su, and I can tell you we've been having a lot of little listening sessions about age-friendly and livable communities. And I wanted to make sure listeners know that AARP actually has been a leader in age-friendly communities. They've developed 8 domains of livability, including biking and walking as all part of that. Our senior population out here has grown 40% in the last 5 years, and we all should know that what's good for an 8-year-old is good for an 80-year-old. Mm-hmm. So this is really, really great conversation, and I encourage people to look at there's a website, aarp.org/livable. Livable communities, and you will see a lot of information there that's already been done. There's about 130 designated age-friendly communities in the lower 48, and hopefully at some point in the future we'll have one here in Alaska too.
All right. Well, thanks.
So I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Really glad you called with this information. Thanks so much, Terry. And let's stay with the phones for just a moment. We're going to go to Skagway now. Ellen is in Skagway. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have a big concern, a totally different angle, and that is tourism. We have a company that takes tourists up to the top of a narrow mountain road down which cars have been traveling. When they arrive there, it's probably 50 miles an hour going down the hill. 40 is the max, but, you know, as you said before. And these tourists, big groups of tourists, ride up to the top, get rides up to the top. They truck the bicycles up there, and then they veer out in the road. They have a front and back employee, but nobody in the middle. And it's just a matter of time. I mean, people do get hurt, and it gets swept under the carpet, doesn't get advertised. But it's just a matter of time till something serious happens. Cars get impatient coming down the hill in competition with these bicycles who say, well, we have every right to the road, and yet they're only going, you know, very slowly, and they're ignorant, basically, bicyclists, I don't know what can be done. I wish one of you experts would come over here and advise this situation.
All right. Well, Ellen, I appreciate your concern. I can hear the exasperation in your voice and your worry about someone getting hurt. And these are very important points when we're talking about multi-use and people sharing the road, Steve?
Sure, and I think that gets back to the responsibility I was talking about earlier. Both individual responsibility and in this case, the commercial entity has responsibility there as well. And so the fact that you're 15, 20 bicyclists doesn't mean that that you don't have to abide by the rules of the road and the responsibility that comes with that. And so it does sound like a dangerous situation, and in our work to encourage more people to walk and bike is focused on building community and not simply a commercial enterprise that's going to take people up to the top and send them down.
Yeah, just kind of let them go and hope they make it to the bottom. Thanks, Ellen, for that call. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the importance of sharing the roadways between all users as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/we are. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Looking through, we have an enthusiastic audience today, lots of emails, and Paul is in Palmer. We just heard from Terry in the Matsu Valley, and Paul is a bicycle commuter and runs a bike rickshaw business. Mm. And he ticked off a number of concerns in the Palmer area, weak road and trail infrastructure. He says the biggest safety issue is driver attitude and the police response that say, we can't really do a whole lot. So he is saying in closing that Alaska is sort of in the 1950s with a lack of pedestrian and wheel-friendly approaches. What's your sense of that, Steve? I'm sure that there's differing pockets of progressive thinking when it comes to these kinds of things and others. But on balance, how do you think Alaska fares in our communities in that regard?
I put us a few more decades ahead of that. Anchorage did adopt a bike plan in 2010, and perhaps even then that may have been outdated. But in my nearly 20 years here, and most of that, or a lot of that spent on a bike, I see continued bike lanes being developed and other bicycle and pedestrian improvements. And so as I bike down to my office downtown, I typically get off the trailer at the Sullivan Arena, and now I can get on a bike lane on A Street that takes me right downtown. And then I share the road with other vehicles when I'm downtown. So I see incremental improvements. I don't think it's exactly where we want it to be, and I'm sure lots of people have that attitude for any number of issues. But I see a lot of positive movement. I mentioned the Transportation Alternatives Program. The mayor and the city of Anchorage got nearly $1 million to implement a Vision Zero program, which will try to reduce collisions and crashes between pedestrians and bicyclists. So that focus on safety, I think, is going to go a long way to improving lots of the things that Paul was mentioning in the Matsu, and hopefully that'll broaden out statewide and that people will see that streets are meant to share.
Mark, when you were here, we discussed where the kind of transportation changes that you promote work the best. And some may be surprised to know that it's not just California communities. Winter cities are often some of the biggest success stories. Tell us about, in just a minute or so, tell us about Denver and Madison and other places that you've seen that have really changed neighborhoods through this, and how there is concrete evidence now of the health impacts from that.
Absolutely. We're seeing communities from, for example, Houghton, Michigan, which is where Michigan Tech is. It's in the upper peninsula of Michigan. They get a ton of snow every year. Traverse City, the one we mentioned before, lower peninsula, but also a lot of snow. But Madison, Wisconsin, Burlington, Vermont. Many of them are university towns, by the way, because there's that ready population of users. You build a bike network, boom, students are ready to jump on. You build a good transit network. You build pedestrian facilities. Those university students often lower rate of car ownership, they're ready to jump on. But then you find everybody else takes advantage of it. And the research shows us, as you build this infrastructure, you know, that's the old question, if you build it, will they come? They will. They will over time. It doesn't happen instantly. You don't put in the bike trail and then tomorrow 3,000 bicyclists on it. But even in cold weather environments, we're seeing good success. Cities like Minneapolis, Denver, the ones I've just mentioned, have to make very thoughtful decisions about maintenance. So it's not just about building the trails, but, you know, in a cold weather environment, you're going to have to repave more often. And more importantly, you're going to have to keep them plowed or decide which you're going to groom for skiing, which you might leave natural, and which you're going to plow because they're bike commuter routes. Most places have sort of a hierarchy, and they have arterial routes on their trail network, just like you have arterial roads that get cleared every day because you know lots of people are commuting on those. Here's the interesting tidbit. We see from the research that these are the same kinds of places that are likely to have statistically lower rates of obesity. As we see communities begin to build the network and make land use decisions so that things are close enough together that I can walk a bike and take transit from work to school to shopping to home, we actually see behavior shift reflected in actual health outcomes in those communities, which is pretty powerful.
And we only have a couple minutes left, but let's talk a little bit about what citizens can do. We've heard from a lot of callers. There's a lot of interest in this. People have concerns. Alaskans like to be out. Is it as simple as just going to your city assembly meeting and saying, hey, we want complete streets designs here? Or Steve, what do you recommend, and Mark also, for citizens to do to help push this forward? Because as we know, engineers normally consider when they're building roads, how do we move traffic the fastest?
Sure. Well, I like to start out with talking about common courtesy, and whether you're walking, taking transit, biking, or driving, and maybe all of those in one day or in one week, to be courteous and to remember that it's somebody else's son or daughter or grandma or grandpa that is out there. And that respect and showing that you know the rights and the responsibilities can really go a long way. We hope to be helping advocate for a complete streets policy here in the city, and on a bigger scale, Safe Routes to School, a rejuvenation of the Safe Routes to School policy statewide. But citizens can get involved and let their elected officials know, both on the city level and the state level, that this is important to them, and they want to see an investment from them. And the good part about the Transportation Alternatives Program is that it's federal money designed for this kind of stuff, and it can really help to improve our communities, even when the state budget is in decline.
All right, Mark, do you want to add some suggestions there?
Yeah, don't let the one bad apple contaminate the culture. You know, you can have one grouchy driver or one indifferent bicyclist who blows through signal lights and stop signs, and everybody says, oh, bicyclists don't adhere to the rules, or drivers don't care. And that's not true. You know, let's actually be part of that cultural change. I'm right with Steve on that. And I'm going to remind drivers, even if you're never going to ride your bike to work or never going to walk or take the bus, remember that everybody who is one less car on the road that you're competing with. So if you're a driver and you see somebody, a pedestrian trying to get across the road, or a bicyclist, remember that's one car. You're not competing with a parking space, right? That's one less car that's not in the lane with you. That's actually, so they benefit all of us every time we walk, bike, or take transit. And I'll remind you that the culture is shifting. We have the lowest rates of driver licensure among 16 to 24 year olds that we've seen in the last 30 years. It's actually dropping. So in other words, that next generation, the Uber users, you know, the kids that know about Zipcar and stuff like that and ride their bikes and walk, they actually think about transportation differently. So we need to get them actively involved to show up at those public meetings, at the hearings, and be a voice, because the economic community, the business community listens to those voices. That's that next generation of employees that we want to hire. I think we've got to connect the business community very explicitly to this conversation. You want healthcare costs to go down? Build a world where it's easy for people to be physically active as part of their daily lives. It's one of the best preventive medicines we have. So the business community, I think, should be a loud and strong voice for this work across Alaska, and certainly in your big city.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I have a lot of emails that we didn't get to. And Steve, I'm going to see if I can forward those on to you, and maybe you can get back to these folks that had questions and concerns. Thanks to all of our callers. Thank you to WGBH for hosting Mark Fenton to be on the program with us today. And also to Steve Cleary, Executive Director of Alaska Trails. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.